From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Goodbye, winter. Hello, spring. Happy birthday, by the way, to truck driver Jody from Nurse Vicky. And later tonight, The Hat Man with Heidi Hollis. Here's what's happening. And this just happened. Passengers traveling from about a dozen countries will be barred from carrying most electronic devices on U.S.-bound flights. The airlines from certain countries in the Middle East and Africa will require passengers heading to the U.S. to check their laptops and tablets. The directive is reportedly the result of a security threat, and that could be announced as soon as tomorrow morning. North Korea has threatened to reduce the United States to ashes as tensions with North Korea continue to increase. The secretive state released a statement earlier this month warning Donald Trump of nuclear destruction if America fires even a single bullet towards North Korea. Dr. Jerome Corsi, who writes for Infowars.com. Jerry, this is getting out of hand, isn't it?
It's ratcheting up. Certainly the rhetoric and the threats coming out of North Korea are intensifying. And we've, of course, increased our military presence in South Korea. We've sent in drones. We have a missile defense system. And, George, you know, it looks increasingly like a confrontation, a military confrontation, is what North Korea wants. Although I don't think it's going to be the first step the Trump administration takes. I think sanctions will be the first thing really on the table. But it's hard to see where it goes when you get North Korea being so continuously aggressive, firing missiles and being constantly threatening.
Well, and so, you know, if you had a neighbor, Jerry, that kept saying, I'm going to shoot you one day, what would you do?
Eventually you'd want to make sure they were taken out so you didn't have to deal with
it. Yeah, call the cops, do something. My gosh. By the way, I've been reading your work on Infowars.com. Amazing stories. I'll have to talk with you and Alex about that in the not-too-distant future. But keep up the work, okay?
Thank you, George. Really appreciate it. Look forward to discussing.
Dr. Jerome Corsi. Patient. President Trump again went outside Washington to whip up support for House Republicans' health care bills on Monday, telling a rally in Louisville, Kentucky, that the legislation is our chance to end Obamacare and the Obamacare catastrophe. In Louisville, of course, Connie Willis, our weekend host on Coast to Coast, and we have a feature called Where's Willis? So where is Willis tonight?
Willis is at a after-party Trump rally, having a good time. Exhausted, but having fun. It was great. Oh, my gosh, you know? I was never into politics before all this happened. It was the most entertaining time I've ever seen of politics, and so I got involved in it. And it was like a giant pep rally. There were people there, George, of all sizes and shapes and ages and colors, and I actually saw a lot of uniting going on. I talked to some people that they had said, because there were a ton of people there. I got there early, and these people were lining up since 5 a.m.
Wow.
It didn't even start till after 7:30, and, you know, Trump's always late to these things. And, you know, there were people that said they had voted for someone else, and they said, hey, you know what, we're kind of getting into this, we're seeing things we like, and we want a chance to see him, you know, while history's being made. And it was a lot of unity. I was very pleasantly surprised.
Was there a lot of excitement out there, Connie, as if, wow, the president is here?
Yeah. And then, you know, of course, you know, he's a pro at this. He goes from city to city and speaks. And, you know, you go to city to speak, and you always make sure you say something specific to that city. And when he did, of course, he did it right. You know, he talks about basketball. And he said, hey, you know, because Louisville lost in March Madness.
Oh, I know. What an upset.
Right? But he didn't mention Kentucky, so the Kentucky fans in Louisville, you're split, right? So people are like, hey, wait a minute. But he had said, hey, you guys worry about basketball, I'll take care of the rest. And, you know, it just made people laugh and then made people feel good, too. It was a really feel-good kind of night.
All right, Connie, thank you so much. Where's Willis? She pops up all over the country. We really just never know where she's going to be. David Rockefeller, the banker and philanthropist with the family name who controlled Chase Manhattan Bank for more than a decade and wielded vast influence around the world for even longer as he spread the word of American capitalism, is dead. He died at his home in New York. He was 101. Well, I'm sure most of you have probably heard over the weekend Chuck Berry with his amazing guitar, self-confidence, memorable songs about cars, girls, wild dance parties, did as much as anyone to define rock and roll's potential and attitude in the early years, has died at his home near Wentzville, Missouri. He was 90 years old. Chuck Berry, just a legend across the world. And they loved him in St. Louis as well. There's an area called Blueberry Hill devoted to him. Back in 1985, I had a little production company, television production company, and Chuck Berry used to come in there all the time. He wanted VHS dubs of his work. In those days, that was it, VHS. And we would do it for him, and he'd say, well, let me write you a check. How much do I owe you? And I said, none, Chuck. Just take it and go. But that was our experience with Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry, dead at the age of 90 years old. In Pennsylvania, a 5-year-old boy who was accidentally choked when investigators say, and I want you to hear this, the family dog pulled his scarf too tightly around his neck and he died. Parents, please be careful. Now, while some conservative groups may wait for tax-exempt status, the IRS swiftly gave approval for a satanic cult that sponsored an after-school Satan club, according to records picked up by Judicial Watch. Unbelievable. The sun is currently blank with no visible sunspots. It's the 14th straight day with a blank look. But what else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Busy a few days for you, Stephen.
Absolutely, George, and a wonderful time here as we welcome everyone, as you did at the top of the program. Happy vernal equinox, a great time, as we know, to start looking at some amazing things in the sky. But what you did mention before, I wanted to comment further, the sun, as we know, going through this 11.5-year basic sunspot cycle, or 12-year cycle, the third weakest cycle that we've seen since the year 1755, and this is an onslaught of the potential for more cosmic rays, of course, as the solar wind possibly weakens. But an interesting thing, the sun, of course, has its own internal mechanisms, and we're still trying to understand the correlation between that and the whole concept of climate change. But also something fascinating this week, George, in the world of space sciences, a European group of scientists known as PT scientists are building a lunar robotic series of rovers that are hopefully going to be launched around the year 2018 and go to that beautiful site where Apollo 17, the last manned mission to the moon lies, and Taurus Littrow. And something fascinating the listeners need to know, the actual robotic spacecraft are partially to be manufactured by the Audi Car Corporation, and scientists there hopefully to prove that we did go to the moon and indeed go out to where the lunar rover sits and see how it has endured its endurance in the sun for over 46 years. But in the live sky, here's something really cool. If you look into the western part of the sky just after sunset, don't stare into the sun, but Venus goes into conjunction, meaning it moves into the glare of the sun on the 25th. How close can you see it in the sky? That's something with binoculars and telescopes, but be careful because of the sun's overpowering light. You should see a beautiful crescent. Finally, a comet, George. We haven't talked about comets in a while. Comet 41P is a comet called Tuttle-Giacobbe-Cresac. And folks, if you look up to the Big Dipper, high into the northeast sky, just as the moon goes new, and no excuse if you have clear skies, take a pair of binoculars. From now until the 24th, this comet, which has a coma, though faint, the size of the full moon, with a pair of binoculars, you may get to see it gliding through this part of the sky through the giant bowl of the Big Dipper, only 14 million miles away. And as we always say, George, it's an amazing time here. It's spring. Always remember simply to keep your eyes to the skies. Great stuff to come in April.
Don't get away yet, Stephen. Tomorrow night, you and Tom Danheiser are doing what?
Well, George, I wanted to save the best for last. We're honored to be here in Lancaster, California. This is my second mission on NASA's beautiful 747 Sophia. Tom, of course, will join us as we're heading out, as we're told, sometime after 8 p.m., heading up to the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. for about a 10-hour flight.
Oh, 10 hours?
This is going to be amazing. We're going to be looking at the star Betelgeuse. We're going to be looking at the star Vega and Sirius and so many other objects. George, hopefully we'll do what we did about a year and a half ago, do this live from the 747 somewhere as we head up to Alaska.
All right, Stephen. Tom's going to try to hook up with us via Skype tomorrow night while he's flying 40,000 feet in the air. He's going to be on a plane for 10 hours, folks, 10 hours. The longest he's ever been on a flight was from L.A. to Toronto with about 10 stops in between. So this is going to be interesting. And as you know, we highlight podcasts twice a month. Tonight, End of Days.
Not so long ago was the anniversary of the Phoenix Lights incident. What's your opinion on that whole mass sighting? Was it one of ours or was it from elsewhere?
Well, this is a very good question because I base everything on hard, tangible, solid, irrefutable documentary evidence.
Correct.
I have not seen, of course, there have been so much hype about the 1997 Phoenix Lights incident, and so much hype has actually muddied the waters of what may really have happened. We just don't know exactly what happened. Anybody that states dogmatically that Phoenix sightings of 1997 were proof of extraterrestrial arrival is just, they don't know what they're talking about.
And longtime radio enthusiast Michael Deacon hosts End of Days. Michael, great show. How long have you been doing this?
Oh, I've been doing this for about 5 years now, George.
Having fun?
Oh, lots and lots of fun. And first and foremost, I must say, George, it's an honor and privilege to share the air with you here. Never in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine being here with you.
I'm glad you are. You put together innovation, and it's fun. And I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. And, Michael, if people want to listen to the End of Days, how do they find you?
You can go to michaeldeacon.com, and all the information is right there on the website, michaeldeacon.com.
You try to find the truth in everything you put on the program, every guest. With everything that's happening around this planet today, what do you find for a radio host, for you, to be the most challenging thing?
Well, the most challenging thing is the most simplest one, George, being honest. Not everyone is honest, George. Everyone is just totally suppressed with different ideas out there, and everyone's scared to step up and speak the truth, no matter how bad it hurts.
Good for you. Keep doing it. And again, where can they listen to you?
MichaelDeacon.com.
You got it. We shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about the fourth turning, an American prophecy. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Neil Howe back with us. Neil, of course, has a number of books that he's written. We're going to go through a lot of them tonight. He is a historian, economist. He writes and speaks frequently on generational change in American history, co-founder of Life Course Associates, which is a marketing human relations company and strategic planning consultancy serving corporate, government, and not-for-profit clients. We are talking about his work, The Fourth Turning. And you wrote that in, was it 1997, Michael, Anil?
Yes, 1997.
Excellent. And, of course, you wrote Millennials Rising, Generations, that we've talked about on the program with you before. But what a time to talk about the fourth turning, because as we go into cycles, I think we're in one strange one right now, aren't we?
Well, you could say that. We had a very unusual election season, I think you can say.
Yes.
A really nasty and polarizing one. And I live in the D.C. area here, so I can see... I've never really witnessed anything like this. A president coming in and just making war kind of on his own institutions. In other words, the executive, the departments that he runs, he's sort of an outsider looking in. He and his staff are declaring war on the deep state, the administrative state, threatening to tear it apart. It's a very interesting time right now, you know, and all that's led up to this. Of course, the deepening polarization of political attitudes is something we've seen now for, you know, the last 10 or 15 years. So it's led up to this point.
Do you find that this confrontation, Neil, is refreshing, or is it going to backfire?
Personally, or do you just mean...
Just overall.
I mean, I personally find it fascinating and interesting. I think it's a great time to be alive, to see so many things changing like this. You can be scared of it, or you can just embrace it, right?
Yeah,
and so I choose
right.
to embrace it. It is a dangerous time. You know, we wrote about this, we wrote about fourth turnings in history and kind of what this period brings to America. It brings a sense of historical urgency. It brings a kind of inevitably a civic and political crisis occurs during this era, and it reshapes who we are as a people. Every fourth turning in our history. So we're in one now, as you know, the whole fourth turning idea has received a certain, notoriety recently because of, its entry into the White House.
That's right. His chief strategist and assistant, Steve Bannon, grabbed it, right?
Yeah, and exactly. And I've known Steve for a while. He's a fascinating guy. He's a filmmaker, ever since he gave up Goldman Sachs. I think he's an interesting figure because he's definitely a populist. He's definitely not, you know, a traditional member of the GOP, you know, hates Wall Street, right? But he's not motivated by religion. He's not motivated by politics and ideology the way many of the standard GOP people. He has sort of a cultural or aesthetic view of kind of where he wants the country to go, or where he sees the kind of the opening historically for where America ought to go. I don't know him well, but we've worked on projects together. It's interesting too, George, that our books have really been grasped by both sides of the political aisle. And I would just hasten to
right. That's
add
true.
That because, you know, when Generations first came out in 1991, and that's the book where we kind of, you know, first, you know, invented the kind of the millennial generation label and all that. We sort of looked at this new generation and really advanced some of the basic paradigms that we would talk about later. Our biggest fan back then was Al Gore.
Really?
He sent a copy of the book to every member of Congress. And I would say that the whole concept of the millennial generation has been embraced much more by Democrats than by Republicans. So we have had champions on both sides. I don't really belong to either camp. I mean, when it comes to looking at history, I am analytical. I mean, I look for patterns. I describe what happens, and, you know, if the shoe fits, wear it.
Yeah, you know, I'm like you, Neil. If I try to go right down the middle and call it the way I see it.
One prediction we did make in 1997 was that the fourth turning would bring about the fusion of economic populism with conservative social values. And that is something that either party could have picked up. The Democrats could have picked that up.
It would have helped them.
It would have helped them. And in fact, you know, Trump might have run as a Democrat.
Well, that's true. You know? And he supported a lot of Democratic causes over his lifespan here, over his career.
Right, he did. And so the fact that the GOP and the conservatives kind of picked up the football and ran with it is you could almost say is an accident of history. It could have gone either way, and it kind of happened. It happened this way. And in fact, Bernie Sanders, with his populism, I think, was always a more formidable opponent for Trump than Hillary. And Bernie came close to being his opponent. And as you know, as soon as Bernie Sanders lost, Trump found himself agreeing with half the things Bernie said.
Well, that's true.
Bernie as a club to beat Hillary up with. Remember.
Neil, hold on. We're going to take a break, but we're going to come back for more. The Fourth Turning and American Prophecy. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Neil Howe with us, the historian, economist, and writer, of course. You enjoy writing, Neil, don't you?
I do. It's a life and a lifestyle for me.
Okay, so we left off talking about where this country is headed, but the subtitle of The Fourth Turning is called An American Prophecy. Tell me about that, because that's important.
Well, it's... I was speaking metaphorically. I mean, we definitely have a method that's based on history and on huge amounts of empirical data. We basically look back at the generational experience going back several centuries in American history, and as well as, you know, a number of other societies around the world, and we find that as other social scientists have found, that Arnold Toynbee, you know, notably talked about the great war cycle, you know, great catastrophes, catastrophic wars appearing about once in every long human lifetime, about every 80 or 90 years or so. And we looked at U.S. history and American history and found that, you know, the great civic turning points going back to back in the late 17th century, the Glorious Revolution, the War of Spanish Succession, probably the first global war in Western European history, and then a long human lifetime, about 80 or 90 years, to the American Revolution, and then to the Civil War, and then to the Great Depression and World War II, and then to today. I mean, these are these intervals of about four generations each, and roughly halfway in between, we have the Great Awakenings of American history, right? We even number them.
Oh, sure.
First Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening. Many historians call the late 60s and 70s America's fourth or fifth Great Awakening, depending on whether you want to start your count with, you know, John Winthrop in the 1630s or Jonathan Edwards in the 1740s. But the point is that these seem to be the broad outlines of our history that in these turning points, we either redefine our outer world of politics, empire, and economy, or in the other periods, we redefine our inner world of values, art, religion, culture, and this yin and yang going back and forth between rebuilding outer world and inner world, I think is a very important rhythm that describes most modern societies, not just here, but around the world today. I'd say most of Europe and East Asia are on this similar pattern. And we see, you know, the Trump phenomenon, as you know, is sweeping much of the world. We see it in Europe. I mean, the rise of right-wing populism.
Mm-hmm.
We see rising nationalism in East Asia. We see many of the same currents are not unique to this country. In fact, as you know, half of the Eurosceptic parties in Europe are calling themselves, you know, are deliberately embracing Trump, you know, or Brexit or whatever. You know, Marine Le Pen in France is calling herself Madame Frexit, you know, and so they're all kind of seeing themselves as a movement. They sort of see the affinities with each other and kind of discovering this new kind of coalition, this new perspective of this new ideological perspective. And we're in the middle of it. You know, we think that this generation-long era started in 2008 with the global financial crisis and the election of Barack Obama. We're not quite halfway through it. And it's going to stretch all the way to the year, you know, 2030.
Oh, it sure will. Now, the subtitle, yeah, of course, what though, Neil, is our next rendezvous with destiny? What way are we going to go?
We don't know. That we don't know. So I'm not going to tell you whether it will end well or poorly. I think in American history, these fourth turnings have ordinarily ended pretty well, right? I think you'd have to observe that most of these crises have ended well.
Do they end with a war?
All of the total wars of American history have occurred in these fourth turnings.
Yeah.
And in fact, none have occurred outside of fourth turnings. So you think about that. That's a sobering thought. Remember, in the last fourth turning, we often talk about weapons of mass destruction and how opposed we are to them, and how, you know, the very idea is an abomination. But reflect back, in the last fourth turning, we recruited the best and brightest of our scientists in America. You know, imagine going today to Google, you know, and just recruiting everyone from Palo Alto up and down the coast to invent and build a weapon of mass destruction, right? That was the A-bomb.
Oh, yeah.
And we used it.
And we did. And we also recruited the Nazis for our space program after the war.
That was Wernher von Braun. And, of course, we recruited many of them. But, you know, it's interesting to reflect on other periods. You know, you think of the Civil War, and particularly the last year and a half, the Peninsular Campaign, you know, with Ulysses Grant. You know, how many Union soldiers and Confederate soldiers were dying every week as Grant was just pounding his way down to Richmond and Petersburg. I mean, if we had had a weapon of mass destruction at that time, would we have used it? I think the question answers itself.
Well, now you bring up an interesting paradox, too, because this whack job in North Korea, and he is, you know, is threatening us with nukes. Today, he said, you know, I'm going to threaten you with the mass destruction. We're going to leave you in rubble if you fire one shot at us. Now, somebody's going to do something there.
Well, it's kind of dumb, because what that really is basically he thinks he's intimidating us, but what he's really doing is saying, it's kind of like the homicidal maniac basically pleading, you know, please shoot me now, right?
Yeah. I've got a psychic who calls me regularly. His name's Suleiman, and he's right a lot of times. And, you know, he's pointed these things out about North Korea and things like that. He's echoed some of the things I've said, too. I just think, Neil, my gut tells me I don't know how much more we're going to take here. Now, the Trump administration has kind of not gotten into this arena yet because of all the other issues that have been bombarding it. But eventually he's going to look at it, and he's going to have to make a decision, and a tough one.
And the timing may not be his own. He may be forced, you know.
He may be forced.
People know when there's a danger. And, you know, everyone talks about delivery mechanism. And as you and I know, there are all kinds of ways to deliver an atomic bomb. You could take a freighter down just off the coast of California.
Absolutely.
I mean, come on. I mean, everyone knows what you can do, right?
Yep.
There's various ways of getting it. If they really want to deliver it, they could deliver it now. And I think they know that, you know, the deep state. I mean, all the intelligence services know that. And they've already got all the options on the table for Trump. And he's looking at them. And that is definitely on the table. The problem is that, yeah, we all say we'd love diplomacy and to get, you know, Xi Jinping and China to exert their influence and da-da-da-da. But if you got a crazy guy, right, who fulminates even against China.
Oh, they can't control.
Brother.
Yeah.
We've got a number of none are quite as weird as North Korea, but we've got the Korean Peninsula. We've got the South China Sea. We got the whole situation with Russia and the Baltics.
Don't forget Iran.
Poland. And we've got the Persian Gulf, and we've got the whole situation with Iran. And tensions are rising there as well, particularly within Iran. Now this new election is coming up. So we got a number of hot spots around the world right now.
Does this have all the makings of a third world war?
No, I really don't think so. And in fact, if I were to bet what dimension the fourth turning will take when it actually reaches a crisis, in my opinion, and I still believe this, I think it's more likely to take the form of another financial crisis and economic crunch. It may have geopolitical repercussions. There may also be something happening abroad. I think that is more dangerous. I'm looking at the stock market right now. You know, one of the most unusual things now that's happening is this confluence or this juxtaposition of extraordinary instability in our political sphere right now.
Yes.
Let me give you an example. You can go onto Ladbrokes, which is a a London betting site. You can get 47% odds that Trump will not survive his first term. He will either resign or be impeached. I mean, literally, if you have a friend in London, you could do some interesting arbitrage with the stock market. You can actually get 12 to 11 odds that Trump literally will not be. Okay, so you got that on the one hand, this extraordinary sense of completely unsettled politics.
From the get-go, that's what's so disturbing.
And yet, look at the stock market.
All-time high.
The global, not only is the stock market at all-time high, but valuations. You know, you look at the Shiller's PE, that is to say, long-term earnings, you know, price divided by long-term earnings, and the volatility is incredibly low. So if you take what stock analysts do is they divide these valuation PE by the volatility, and it's called a complacency index. We've never seen financial markets so complacent as now. And yet we've never seen people's impressions of politics as so completely ragged on the edge of complete chaos.
I've had guests on, Neil, all of them say that the market and the economy is headed for disaster, but they keep missing the date. I mean, it keeps getting stronger and stronger.
Well, it gets stronger and stronger, but of course, you know, although the indexes are going up, earnings really aren't going up, and GDP isn't really going up. That's what causes the valuation.
Right. And now interest rates are going up.
And now interest rates are going up. You see, no one minds the stock market's going up if earnings in the economy are also growing, right? That's fine. You know, that doesn't cause a valuations problem. It's when, and really what's, of course, pushing the stock market up is companies are buying back their own shares. You know, that's the only that's the only real positive net buyer in this market. All other institutions are net sellers. But anyway, the companies are buying back their own stock. But we have incredible complacency financially. I think that is something that cannot last. And I think that it was buoyed by the recent election. Every time we see a new election, there's this period of optimism about the economy and about the stock market, and it typically fades after about 3 or 4 or 5 months once economic reality sets in. One fascinating sidelight on this, George, is that this was done by University of Michigan. Michigan, along with the Conference Board, you know, do their confidence survey.
Well, they just came out last week, 13-year high, right?
Yes, but here's the interesting thing. Michigan did this survey, which actually looked at the partisan affiliation of people giving their answers.
Uh-huh.
What's fascinating is that last June, before the election, the Democrats were relatively optimistic. Republicans were pessimistic. That is to say, everyone is interviewed about the economy. You know, all of these, everyone is interviewed either by Conference Board or Michigan. Post-election, this last December, it had reversed like 40
percentage
points.
Well, that's because if you've got a Democrat as president, the Republicans polled aren't going to be too happy about what's going on. So you're going to have that negative factor. And then, as you just said, it flip-flopped.
But here's why this is important. It shows you how ephemeral and untrustworthy all of the what they call soft data on Wall Street. These are confidence indexes. These are the ISM and market indexes. These are all these what they call diffusion indexes. You know, you ask presidents, you know, do you have more orders this year? Do you expect business to do better next year? the soft data since Trump have been exceptionally buoyant. You know, they're through the stratosphere. And all these Republicans are saying, my God, you know, everything's going to be great. The hard data is not confirming this at all. And in fact, if you look now at, you know, the Atlanta Fed GDP now, they're actually projecting lower quarterly growth this first quarter than we saw in this horrible last quarter of last year.
That's not good.
The hard data is weirdly enough, very problematic at the moment. It's really showing no pickup at all, whereas all the soft data is just, you know, exploding. It's an odd moment, George, right now.
It is. My granddaughter was born in 1995, Neil. Would that make her a millennial?
Yes.
Okay.
And a late-wave millennial probably has Xer parents.
And I've got to say this about millennials. They are going to change the face of a lot of things in this country. I mean, they don't read newspapers. They get most of it off their smartphone. They watch television. They listen to radio. They listen to radio a lot on their smartphones, too, and in their cars on their radios like that. But they are going to change the face of, I think, the direction of our economy. What do you think?
I think this generation is going to be enormously influential. And let me just add, I think they have a huge number of strengths and positives, which are being ignored by a lot of the bashing of millennials we've been hearing lately. Even reading, to give you an example, a lot of people aren't aware. According to the National Institute of Arts and many of these recent surveys, millennials are actually reading as much as older people, and they're reading more than Gen Xers did at the same phase of life. Millennials are reading a lot. I sometimes point out that Harry Potter, which is kind of the gateway reading drug for most millennials, right? Some 50% of millennials have read at least one of those books. 33% say they have read all of them.
That's amazing.
Do you know all of the Harry Potter books put together is about 1.1 million words?
Yeah, I know.
Which is about two War and Pieces or about four Moby Dicks in a row. And people complain that they have no patience. Anyway.
Well, are you hopeful for the future of the country?
I'm very hopeful longer term. You know, people
I am too. I'm
very hopeful, and I'm particularly hopeful in younger generations. I'm hopeful in the strength that Gen Xers bring with their grit and resilience and determination, their street smarts. I'm very hopeful in millennials because they bring a certain confidence and optimism in team playing that America needs today. I really think the greatest thing about today's younger generations is that they bring exactly the strengths that older generations today lack. So it makes me very positive.
Wow. You know what's refreshing, Neil, is to have people like you, credentialed people like you, who have this kind of positive attitude about where we're headed. Now, it's going to be bumpy along the way, though, isn't it?
It's going to be very bumpy. So here is our kind of scenario that I'm looking at. It's going to be really bumpy, super bumpy, maybe continued deflation, accelerated deflation. But what I'm really looking forward to now, particularly in the last couple of months, accelerating inflation, it's going to be wild economic.
Okay, stay with us. We're coming back for more with you, Neil. And we open up the phone lines next.